Begin after six taps. One, two, three, four, five, six.
Howdy, y'all. You're listening to the FlixWise podcast. I'm your host, Lady P, no relation to Master P. Unfortunately, my right-hand man, Gabe Haggard, is back at the homestead. But the reason that Gabe is sitting this one out is because we are actually recording this from San Francisco. And as those of you who have read the About FlixWise page know, I'm a graduate of the San Francisco State University Film Program, and I'm so pleased to announce that the renowned SF State film scholar and my mentor, Professor Joseph McBride, will be riding shotgun for this episode. Just to give you a quick rundown of Joe's accomplishments, he was a film critic, reporter, and columnist for the Daily Variety for many years. He's written 17 books. That's right, 17 books.
That's right.
Including two on John Ford. As I mentioned before, he's a professor, but more than that, he's a great teacher. And basically what I'm getting at here is we're going to have someone on the show who actually knows what they're talking about. So that should be a nice change of pace. Seriously, it is such an honor to have you here. Thank you so much for agreeing to do this.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be with you on the show, and congratulations on having your own podcast.
Oh, thank you. And speaking of John Ford, the next film on our list of the greatest films of all time is John Ford's classic Western, The Searchers. Oh, and by the way, did I mention that Joe was actually a contributor to the Sight and Sound Critics poll? So, for our second topic, we're going to discuss how Joe went about choosing his favorite flicks, and we'll see if we can shed some light on how and why the list shaped up the way it did. Finally, since we've got a real-life film professor sitting here, we're going to end the program with Joe's best advice for aspiring filmmakers and film critics. All right, now that the posse's assembled, let's start the show. For our first topic, we will discuss the number 7 movie on the Sight and Sound Critics poll, John Ford's classic 1956 Western, The Searchers. Not only has Joe written 2 books on Ford, he also published an article in Sight and Sound magazine in 1971 called Prisoner of the Desert, which really renewed critical interest in the film. The Searchers stars John Wayne as Ethan Edwards, a veteran Confederate soldier who's looking for work and purpose in post-Civil War America. Basically, he's a wanderer, much like Dion. The story opens with Ethan stopping by the Texas ranch house of his brother Aaron. Ethan hasn't been to see Aaron in years, and Ethan's sister-in-law, his 2 nieces Lucy and little Debbie, and his nephew Ben are all thrilled to have him back at the homestead. Aaron and Martha's adopted adult son Martin, played by Jeffrey Hunter, who is 1/8 Cherokee, is also happy to see Ethan, but Ethan displays a clear wariness and dislike of his so-called half-breed nephew. This happy Edwards family reunion lasts about a day before the local sheriff slash minister, played by the terrific Ward Bond, comes a-calling. He warns Ethan, Aaron, and Martin about cattle thieves prowling the area. Ethan and Martin join the sheriff's posse and set out to find the bandits, while Aaron hangs back home to protect his family and property. However, Ethan, Martin, and the gang discover that the cattle theft was a diversion created by a group of Comanches to ensure that the local farms would be left unguarded. By the time the posse gets back to the Edwards ranch, it is too late. Aaron, Martha, and Ben have been brutally slaughtered, and Lucy and little Debbie are nowhere to be found. This atrocity sets Ethan and Martin on an almost half a decade spanning search, wherein they look high and low for any signs of the missing girls. They find Lucy, or rather Lucy's body, relatively soon after the attack, but Debbie remains elusive. Martin and Ethan crisscross the Great Plains for years, forsaking all personal happiness and earthly pleasures in their obsessive quest to find Debbie. Will Ethan and Martin find her? If they do, will she still be alive? Will she remember them and her life on the Texas ranch, or has she turned totally native? And then the biggest question mark, will Ethan allow Debbie to live after years of living as a Comanche? The answers to all these questions will be revealed in our discussion. So if you have not seen the movie, go to the next topic, because there will be spoilers. Now let's jump right in. Okay, so I start every podcast with this question. It feels a little silly asking you this question, but so do you like this movie?
Well, I love the movie. It used to be my favorite John Ford film. I've gotten a little OD'd on it, I have to admit, because I've seen it so often. It's like Citizen Kane. was my favorite film for a long time, but I've seen that over 100 times, and it makes it hard to watch after a while when you know exactly what the next line will be and everything.
Right.
So The Searchers, I kind of unfortunately wore out a little bit, but I still love the film, and it is one of those films that you keep having different reactions to over time. I'm not sure I discover new things in it. Like, some great films you watch over and over again, you keep finding new things in them. But, I have different emotional reactions to it, which is interesting. I think as you age and grow and change, films seem to change.
Yeah, that was. I was so surprised when I watched it. I rewatched it because for this podcast, and I'd seen it before a few times, but I was so shocked by my reaction in watching it this time because I started tearing up at the end. That had never happened to me before while watching this. It's always been a film that I appreciated, but maybe it didn't speak to me, maybe because I don't know. There was something about the John Wayne character that was off-putting. I
Why?
can't imagine.
Yeah, well, you can't imagine why. Why did you start tearing up, do you think? What?
I'm not sure. The instance where he decides to let Debbie live,
Hmm.
I became emotional for whatever. I don't really know
Oh,
why.
I think I agree. It's very moving. I had an interesting reaction 3 or so years ago when I saw the film again after a gap for a while. That, Ethan is a reprehensible character in a lot of ways because he wants to kill his niece and he's a racist and all this. And then he has this change of heart, which is believable. And when he deposited her back on the front steps at the end of the film, I felt this terrific rush of emotion. Your rush came a little earlier when he let her live. But I had this feeling like, wow, this is an amazing achievement that the guy has actually found her and brought her home despite all the terrible things and all kinds of ironies and things. But, the guy, he set out on a quest to bring her back and he brought her back. And there, I mean, it's ambivalent what kind of life she'll have afterwards. And then he has to turn away from the home because he's realizes he's not fit for a civilized society. But in a strange way, it's like Captain Ahab going after the whale.
Right.
He dies in the process, but the he finds Moby Dick and everything. So there is something about that epic quest that is moving, despite all the ambivalence. And that's what makes the character so interesting, is that we, the things about him that are hateful and things that are lovable at the same time. And that's where, as Walter Hill says in Peter Bogdanovich's directed by John Ford, that ambiguity is the province of the artist. That's where the artist lives, And this film is one of the most ambiguous films ever made.
So you mentioned some of the issues many people have, brought up about the Ethan Edwards character. He's racist. He's unfeeling, or at least he appears to be unfeeling. He's very, very stubborn. But what do you think draws people to Ethan Edwards?
Well, I mean, for one thing, it's one of the great performances ever on film. Jimmy Stewart, I interviewed, and he said, I think John Wayne gives one of the greatest performances I've ever seen. And I mean, he
That's a
didn't,
really good Jimmy Stewart, by
yeah,
the
he didn't, often compliment people, but I mean, he appreciated his fellow actors. But it is an amazing performance. Part of it is it's a kind of a scary thought, but Harry Carey Jr., who I knew, wrote about this, that he said Wayne was usually kind of an easygoing, relaxed kind of guy on the set, but on this film, he was totally different. He was the character. He was kind of frightening. Even when they had lunch, he would be glaring at you. He was in character. And Wayne gave interviews where he made it clear he totally identified with Ethan. But he's a great actor. And Ford, I think Wayne was not perhaps the smartest guy in the world, but Ford understood how to use Wayne well and to situate that kind of performance in a film that is very thoughtful and has complexities that I think Wayne maybe didn't even realize.
So, do you think it's primarily Wayne's performance that draws people into this
Oh,
character?
well, yeah, you asked what it is. I mean, it's more than the performance, which is great, but it's a very American story. It's a profoundly American story. There were many captive narratives, they used to call them, in the 1800s. This was a staple of fiction. Both serious fiction and pulp fiction was Indians kidnapping white women. And my friend Glenn Frankel wrote an excellent book called The Searchers, The Making of an American Legend, which I would recommend. And he deals with the making of the film and the meaning of the film, but also the real story that inspired it, which was the story of Cynthia Ann Parker, who was a white girl in Texas who was kidnapped by Indians and lived with Comanches. And she had an uncle who was the model for Ethan Edwards. Alan LeMay wrote the novel that The Searchers, the film was based on, but he based this on this real story, and he changed some things around. But in real life, Cynthia Ann didn't want to come home, and they brought her home. Basically, she's abducted twice, which happens in the movie too, right. First by the Indians and then by the white people. But it's a different story in reality because she didn't want to come home at all. Debbie says, I don't want to come home, but then she has this the one big flaw in the film is when she changes her mind and says, yes, 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 Martin, you know, right. Like it's not motivated that she'd want to go home. But in reality, she desperately didn't want to come home, and they brought her, and she kept trying to escape, and she finally she starved herself to death, missing her Indian family. And one of her sons became the famous Comanche chief, Quanah Parker, the last war chief of the Comanche tribe, who's a great American figure who Ford once wanted to make a film about. So it's a great American story. It has a lot of our Western myth in it. It deals with genocide. It deals with pioneering, our ambivalent feelings that we have today. You know, in the 50s, it's interesting, when this film came out, it got really good reviews in America. And even, you know, like Look magazine said this is an instant classic. They recognized that it was a terrific film. It wasn't like it was neglected. But none of the reviews at the time recognized that Ethan was a racist. It's fascinating. Mm-hmm. Variety's review said there's something wrong with this character, but we can't quite figure out what it is. They kind of implied it was a flaw in the film. Mm. And I think our society was so racist in 1956 that they didn't even notice that this guy was a racist. It was ingrained in our culture that this is the way a Western hero would behave. And they didn't recognize that Ford was casting doubt on the whole concept of Western heroism in this film. And Ford was showing us a very mixed view of this man. And so, it took a while for people to figure that out.
Do we know if that was Ford's intention, that Ford believed Ethan was a racist?
Well, I think it's quite clear in the film. A lot of Ford's later films deal with race. That's one reason I like Ford, was that, you know, he was an Irish-American, son of immigrants, and he always had an acute sensitivity, more than most American directors, to ethnicity and race. And he grew up in a multi-ethnic neighborhood in Portland, Maine, and always had different ethnic groups in his films, as opposed to, say, Howard Hawks, who only has basically WASPs in his films, and an occasional, I mean, there's hardly any black people in Hawks' films. The same, Frank Capra hardly has any black people, and when they're in there, they're just stereotypes. Ford has some stereotypes, but he's trying to deal with our multi-layered ethnicity in his work, and often that becomes issues in his films, but he is a product of his culture, and he is a white American, and he wasn't perfect and had his own biases and things like that.
Right. It seems like he was intentionally vague, particularly with reporters. Was this all just a means of him preventing getting pigeonholed or?
Well, yeah, he, and I've come to respect this. When I was 23 and I interviewed him, I was very frustrated that he wouldn't really talk very frankly to me. I was with him for like an hour, which was valuable for me when I wrote my biography, because just being in his presence for an hour, I could pick up a lot of nonverbal things and a lot of things about his personality. But, you know, I wasn't getting much out of him in terms of quotable material, although he did retire in the course of my interview. He announced his retirement. Actually, that was a big scoop. In the middle of the interview, toward the end, he says, I'm just a hard-nosed, hard-working, ex-director, and I'm trying to retire gracefully. And I was kind of shocked. And he kept asking his secretary, has the call come from the Italian gentleman, the gentleman from Italy? He kept asking, and he was anxious about this. And I wondered what that was about. And many years later, I found his papers, and I looked for that period. And what was happening was Woody Strode had become a star in Italian Westerns and was trying to get Ford a job directing an Italian Western. Ford hadn't managed to get a film made in Hollywood for 5 years, mm-hmm. which was really terrible. And so there was some Italian producer who Ford thought might produce a film, and he was waiting for the call, and it never came. I actually arrived the day his career ended. And he was in the middle of this, and the last thing he wants to do is talk to some 23-year-old kid about his old movies.
So good timing and bad timing. Terrible timing. By the way, Mr. Ford, can we talk about the searchers?
Good luck getting... But you asked a really interesting question. Like, why did he do this? I was not the only person. This was his mode with most interviewers. There are a few expansive Ford interviews under certain circumstances, but normally he would stonewall people and pretend to be, as one of his friends said, he played the role of this crazy Irishman who you could never get a straight answer to a question from. And this guy pointed out, Alexander Jacobs, screenwriter, this was Ford's defense mechanism. He said it was a marvelous defense mechanism in Hollywood. And Ford said to Hedda Hopper, at one point, he said, you know, I pose as an illiterate, but don't tell anybody. And so he created this persona, the whole, Olive Carey, who knew him longer than anybody I had talked to, the actress, she's in The Searchers, she said that Ford was always acting. She said he was the greatest ham of all time and created this whole personality to hide who he really was, which was a very sensitive, kind, sweet guy in a way. But you know, in America and in Hollywood, if you're a kind, sweet guy, and if you think of yourself as an artist and tell people you're an artist, you're going to get killed. And look what happened to Orson Welles and Eric von Stroheim and people who went around proclaiming their artistry. You know,
did he really need that eye patch, or was he just putting it on to scare people?
That's a good question. He, one of his associates said, "Well, Ford can't hear and he can't see, but." He actually knows more about what's going on than anybody else. So maybe it was partly a pose. You know, it was a way to keep people at a distance.
I'd like to think that it was a pose.
I think he exploited it to some extent that, you know, he was this... I mean, he lived inside his own head very deeply. He was very introverted in his own strange way.
Well, getting back to The Searchers. So Ethan Edwards, he's not just... you know, a bigot or a stubborn bully. There's obviously something there that people identify with.
Well, there's some great virtues in him. He's capable of great kindness and sensitivity and great insensitivity and great cruelty. And one of the things you mentioned is he arrives back home after having been away for, 3 years after the Civil War. This is 1868 when the film starts. And then almost immediately the family is slaughtered by Indians. And Mike Wilmington and I came up with this idea that, you know, the film is sort of dreamlike and not meant to be entirely realistic. It's almost like his guilty desires take place the minute he arrives. Mm-hmm. Like he wants to violate the woman and destroy the husband and destroy the family. And his surrogate, Scar, does that for him. Scar is, as we said, a crazy mirror of Ethan. Mm-hmm. He's very similar to Ethan. The film makes it clear that there is a similarity between these two guys. And Scar, even though he's a villain of, in a lot of ways, Ford gives him the motivation that some of his family has been killed by white people.
Right.
So he says, for each son, I take many scalps. Ford's greatest, the things he valued the most in the world were home, family, community, tradition, you know, and yet all these things are destroyed all the time in his films. Mm-hmm. He dwells on the destruction of his ideals, which makes him really interesting, I think, as an artist. And Ethan is kind of like that. He thinks he values the family, but he's a destroyer of the family. Mm-hmm. You know, when he finds Lucy... we don't see what happens. One of the great things about the script in the film is the ellipsis that it uses. Makes you wonder what happens at different parts of the film. Part of it is because it's dealing with things that were in that society were considered unspeakable. And not to be discussed, you know, in polite society or whatever, like miscegenation, although he mentions it a couple times. But when he finds Lucy back in the canyon, I began wondering whether he killed Lucy, you know, and I think the film supports this ambiguity.
Interesting.
He either found her body and buried it, which is what he said he does, or he found her and killed her.
Wow. That didn't occur to me. Wow.
Because he comes back and he's very distracted and seems very distraught, and he's got this knife and he's digging in the sand. People can interpret that as he's just finished burying the body. Mm-hmm. digging in the sand, but it could be he's just used the knife cleaning on her and he's cleaning, wow. cleaning the knife, you know?
Wow.
So he might have killed Lucy, and he's kind of symbolically responsible for Martha getting killed and the rest of the family. And,
wow. Well, okay, you know. Yeah, that interpretation where he kills Lucy, I feel like there is ambiguity in the character, mm-hmm. but if your theory is correct, that ambiguity is completely gone. I think then he goes from perhaps anti-hero to villain.
Well, he is kind of, villainous in some ways, but he's an anti-hero. I mean, anti-hero is the right word, and that became a popular thing in the late 50s and 60s. You know, there are all kinds of characters in American films who were anti-heroes. Bogart, in his own way, before that, was kind of an anti-hero.
I think he's probably the quintessential anti-hero.
Yeah. And so people who are not one thing or another, they're kind of a mixture of good and bad. And
right.
That's what makes, I think we're fascinated by people who are mixtures of good and bad,
right.
as we all are, and we all have some Ethan in us.
Yeah.
I mean, he's an extreme example of all that, and we can also view it as a cautionary tale that we don't want to be like him. But there's something admirable about a guy who says, I'm going to do something epic, and then I do it,
right.
even if it's crazy. There's an interesting interview Ford gave to Jean Matry, who wrote a book about him in France. Right before he made The Searchers, he was in France, and he said, I would like to do a tragedy the most serious in the world that turned into the ridiculous.
Mm.
And I think The Searchers is that film, because Ethan is this... He's supposed to be like the heroic knight who goes off to save the abducted maiden, you know. But then you find out he's trying to kill her, which makes the whole quest obscene or wrong.
Right.
And then he keeps losing her, and then other people keep finding her, and then he keeps losing her again. And then she winds up being found right nearby.
Yeah.
Like she's found...
She hasn't gone anywhere.
She hasn't gone anywhere. He could have stayed home for 5 years, sitting on the porch in his rocking chair, and she would have shown up, which is what happens. The quest is ridiculous.
Yeah.
And it's like the Roadrunner movies, which also take place in Monument Valley.
Yeah.
And I think they're very similar to The Searchers, is that Wile E. Coyote is constantly trying to kill the right. Roadrunner, and he never succeeds.
Right.
And
he always ends up looking foolish.
Yeah, and things blow up in his face all the time, just like with Ethan, who right. becomes kind of a comical character in a strange way.
I feel like the anvil is always falling on Martin, though. You know, like Ethan's always setting him up.
Yeah.
But somehow the anvil always manages to land on Martin. I don't know.
Martin, what I think happens with Martin is he becomes the hero of the film gradually.
Right.
We think Ethan's the hero, but Martin is the guy we identify with, and he's a very modern kind of guy.
Right.
He seems like a modern American, and he's part Indian. We can relate to him because he's a decent person. He doesn't want his kin killed, you know, and he's trying to stop Ethan, and so he's the guy we begin to root for after a while.
So back to the comedic elements of the movie. The film feels to me very dark. There are a lot of dark themes. So when we do have these comedic flourishes, these slapsticky almost elements, it feels like a tonal shift.
Mm-hmm.
But it's interesting what you're saying about how that is in fact integral, because the whole thing is a farce.
It becomes farcical, but there are some very serious moments in the middle of farce too. And one of the things that Ford does very characteristically is he will follow a very serious scene with a comical scene. And then, like, for example, Ethan finds Debbie and he says, "Let's go home, Debbie." It's very emotional. What does it cut to? It cuts to the scene where Ward Bond is there with his ass sticking out because Patrick Wayne has stabbed him in the ass. And they're picking shrapnel out of his rear end. It's this really low comedy. And it's funny. But then it goes to the ending, which is another very emotional scene where they bring her home. That's important to Ford to break that, because for one thing, it gives you a sense of pause between these two emotional scenes. It'd be hard to sustain that emotion.
So back to John Wayne. The Ethan Edwards character is a pretty major departure for him. I remember seeing Stagecoach and just comparing that Ringo, is that his name? The Ringo?
Ringo Kid.
The Ringo Kid. Comparing the Ringo Kid to Ethan Edwards, somehow there's there seems to be like a dishonesty in the portrayal of the outlaw as kind of a gentleman.
Oh.
You know, whereas the Ethan Edwards character, some of his later work, yes, he is, he's, again, he's racist, he's brutal, misogynist. I mean, so to me, that's more honest. That's a more honest depiction of the outlaw character.
That's interesting. Yeah, Ford had what we called the noble outlaw in a lot of his films. So when Ford has a noble outlaw, he's showing somebody who's kind of basically a good man, but he's gone into a bad occupation, maybe kills people or robs banks or something. And the Ringo Kid is a sort of a sweet guy, but he's motivated by revenge, and he's broken out of prison, and so he's like a nice young guy, but he's gotten into trouble, and then he kills three people at the end of the film, but it's tolerated by the sheriff and by Ford.
Yeah, they had it coming.
So, but it's, I think Ford likes the paradox that you like this guy and you feel that he's a nice fellow, but it is troubling. But I think you're right that one reason the later films seem more satisfying is that we see, if you're going to kill three men, that's a pretty tough thing to do.
Yeah.
And it does, you know, it's kind of hard to be just a nice, sweet guy all the time if you're going to kill people occasionally.
Right, yeah.
Like, it's sort of a myth that, you know, you walk down the street at high noon and have this very decorous gunfight.
Right, yeah. That was one thing that really struck me with this movie was, often you watch Westerns and you can see yourself in, you can see yourself in this situation, and you can see yourself as maybe a frontiers person. But in this movie, I've never felt more grateful to live in the era in which I live. I can't imagine trying to, you know, coming here from Sweden or wherever and moving to Texas, you know, only to have, you know, raids on your property. And it just, all of it's just so horrifying, you know.
That's true.
And I think that is what's like that opening shot, that iconic opening, actually the shots that kind of bookend the movie, where you just, the door opens and there's nothing.
Right.
You know?
It's the desert, which is symbolic of kind of elemental bleak living. And yet Monument Valley is a place where people live. The Navajo people live there. That's their home.
Right.
And some of them live in elemental conditions in hogans like their ancestors. And they believe in that. And they think it's, you know, this is their tradition. I interviewed one of the stuntman, Billy Yellow, who was one of the writers in all 10 films Ford made, Monument Valley, Billy Yellow was in all of them. And he was 96 years old, and he lived in a hogan without electricity or running water. And I said, what do you, you know, I tried to get him to talk about Ford's Westerns. What do you think of them? And he said he had never seen a motion picture. He was 96 years old. So to him, he was living the kind of life that people lived 100 years ago or 200 years ago. And the Indians, the Navajos, had great sense of humor, I realized, from getting to know them. Yeah. They felt comfortable enough talking to me that they were able to make a lot of jokes. And I said, so what did you think of Westerns? They said, well, you know, like, there's always a scene where a white man fires a rifle and five Indians fall off their horses.
Right.
I call that the magical rifle of the white man. You know, and so they would always crack up. But, you know, see, they didn't. We might think they would get angry and upset, but they found it funny.
Why does Ethan spare Debbie in the end?
That's a good question. In the script, it's made explicit, and Ford cut it out, which is a good thing. Ethan says something to the effect that you sure favor your mother, he says, right at the time when he rescues Debbie. And that makes it too explicit. And it maybe would be too simplistic that that's why he saves her. I think it's complicated because in the first time he goes in the house, like he arrives and then he goes inside, the first thing you see him do in the house is lift Debbie into his arms when she's a child. And it's very affectionate. And then when he accosts her in that canyon, he grabs her by the shoulders and she's very tense. Natalie Wood, you know, she's all tensed up like she thinks he's going to attack her. And she looks terrified. And then it's the physical contact that somehow triggers something in him. And he swings her around. It's a wonderful, beautiful motion. And it's like he's not sure what he's going to do, I think. And then he spins her around and he says, let's go home, Debbie. And then she relaxes and cradles herself against him. It's a wonderful piece of acting.
Yeah.
And one of the things I like about that shot, I've never mentioned this, but the cameraman loses them. The camera operator loses those two characters. The camera is tilting upwards with them and momentarily loses the characters. And I think that's great because it's almost like the cameraman was surprised by what happened, wasn't expecting it. And then actually Martin kills Scar.
Yes.
Again, the heroic, I put heroic in quotation marks, deed where you killed the bad guy is done not by Ethan, but by Marty.
Right.
But then Ethan scalps Scar, which is a very primitive, horrible thing to do. And then he comes out of the tent and his face has that, it's a great close-up, his face looks kind of zombie-like, purged of emotions. And one, Mike Wilmington, my co-author, who was, he's a very good actor too, and he taught me a lot about acting. He thought that his theory was Ethan had purged himself of his hatred by scalping Scar, that he'd gotten it out of his system, and therefore when he went after Debbie, it was more kind of like an automatic response, like I've been planning this for 5 years. But when he got to her, he didn't have any killing left in him, that he had just scalped Scar. And I think there's all these things add up to why it works for us, that we can accept that he doesn't kill her. But, you know, when you're killing Debbie is you know, a pretty horrible thing to contemplate.
Yeah.
So when he touches her and he holds her and he thinks of his lost love, you know, her mother, I think all these things are rushing into his consciousness. And then the echo, Ford very consciously echoes that early scene when we see him lift her. And somehow in his psyche, that moment is buried deeply in his psyche.
Yeah.
And the goodness of the man, or the family side of Ethan, is still there.
Right. There, I think there is this duality to the character. There is the outlaw, the rebel, and there is also this sort of someone who does long for family connection and to some extent for a cause, a reason, you know, and even an institution that he can belong to. He fights for the Confederate army. So he's not a total outlaw. He's not a total nihilist necessarily, or at one point he believed in something.
Yeah, and also the role that he sees himself as the savior of the remnants of the family is a kind of a social act that, however warped or whatever, he sees himself as the savior of the honor of that community. And, you know, like the Confederates had their claim to be motivated by honor, and we see that in a very different light today. But
right. But
he has a sense of right and wrong, however warped it can be.
Right, yeah. That the ending where we see the book, the famous bookend, where that door that opens in the beginning closes on John Wayne. The family is back in the house. John Wayne is out, you know, he's alone. Perhaps we're back where he belongs, off to find a new cause. Why did Ford end the film that way?
Well, it's not in the script. It's funny, I interviewed the cameraman, Winton C. Hoke, who did such a beautiful job, and he said when Ford told him about the ending, he said he thought, how corny can you get? I wouldn't think it's corny. I think it's very chilling in a way. But it's very formalistic and very, very satisfying in a way to bookend the film like that. And you could speculate. It's not clear. It's not spelled out. That's one thing I like about Ford's films. And getting back to the fact that Ford wouldn't explain his films to us, I found frustrating when I was younger, but now I respect that a lot. And I think that's actually one of the motives for him being like that, was he wanted you to look at his films and make up your own mind. And he didn't want to explain it. And I think that's terrific.
Yeah.
So at the end, you kind of think Ethan is going back to the wilderness because he belongs there, as you say. And he's not a civilized man. He's committed acts that render him unsuited for family life. But he could have come in, and he kind of pivots around. It's a very nice piece of acting by Wayne, very moving, where his body slowly turns and he looks sad and kind of resigned and he walks slowly away. I found out that they shot that scene on July 3rd, 1955, and Wayne was hung over because the night before he had started celebrating the 4th of July prematurely.
God, I got a 2-day start on the 4th of July.
Yeah. So they shot this scene about 4:30 in the afternoon, and he was hungover. And that's one reason he walks kind of slowly and lumbering. And,
oh, but, that's perfect.
Yeah. A little bit of insight.
That's funny.
I love those kind of stories. But but it's great physical acting.
Yeah.
And it's also kind of a statement on civilization. The people who do the dirty deeds, like warriors and people who come back from war and all that, we don't really want them around in a certain way. They often have trouble being accepted. But I think there's something dramatic about that, that a warrior or an outlaw is not accepted back into civilized society. There's a barrier they can't cross, and the doorway is a symbol of that.
Yeah. Okay, so just to finish off our The Searchers topic, Joe, you wanted to quickly mention the conservation effort.
Yeah, The Searchers is a film that has some problems in terms of its physical state, unfortunately. I mentioned to Robert Harris, who's one of the great experts on film restoration, who restored Lawrence of Arabia and My Fair Lady and other films, Spartacus, back around 1999 or whenever it was when I met him. I said, you should work on The Searchers next. And he said, he shook his head and said, it's done, it's over. It's gone, is what he said. And what he meant was the yellow layer has collapsed. This was a three-strip Technicolor film. And there were three colored layers on the negative of a film of that kind. And the yellow layer is all yellow. There's no imagery on it. It's gone, you know. And so the versions that we've seen recently, I've seen theatrical prints that don't look very good. And there's also some complicated day for night shooting in the film. Toward the end of the film, for example, there's a sequence where they're about to attack the Indian camp to find Debbie, and it starts out at night, and every shot gets a little lighter and lighter and lighter until dawn is coming up, and then it suddenly cuts to this full sunlight thing as they invade the camp, and it's very spectacular. But it was very carefully timed, you know, when they did the original prints. And I saw the theatrical prints in which it's all shot in broad daylight. They printed for broad daylight. Nobody's around to say, wait a minute, this is supposed to be day for night with the gradual thing. The cameraman's dead and Ford is gone. And so it's just not the same film. It's sad. As I said in my Ford class the other day, when you live long enough, you can see the deterioration of some of the films that you love. And it's a fragile art form. Hitchcock said once, in 100 years, it'll all be cornflakes in a can. That's yeah. So The Searchers, you know, when you asked originally, you know, how do you like The Searchers?
Yeah.
You know, I'm a little, I've sort of worn it out a little, but I also am kind of depressed watching it because it's not quite as beautiful as it was when I first saw it. Warner Brothers, I know, has tried to replicate it, but I guess it'll never be as good as it once was.
Well, on that depressing note,
as the door shuts on film history.
Yeah, exactly. Now, for most podcasts, this is the point in the conversation where I ask all the panelists if they think the movie deserves its spot on the Sight and Sound poll. But this time I want to revisit that question after we finish up our second topic. Time for our second topic. Obviously, I love a good list. I started a whole podcast around the idea that the Sight and Sound Greatest Movies list is a great guidepost for comparing the relative quality and historical significance of a variety of different movies. But I've noticed that a lot of the time our panelists have trouble quantifying how good a movie is, and they have a lot of trouble placing one movie above another. So When it comes time to ask everyone whether they feel a particular film deserves its spot on the poll, people seem to start squirming in their chairs a bit. There's a lot of hemming and hawing going on. Ultimately, I'm not sure whether this discussion will put an end to whatever reluctance people have in making that definitive statement, or whether it'll just exacerbate the problem further. So we'll see. But now, Professor, you are one of the critics who contributed their top 10 list to the poll. Is that correct?
That's right. It was the first time I was asked to do that. They do it every 10 years, and it's, for whatever reason, on years that end with two. So it's like 1972, 82, 92, 2002, 2012.
So can you tell us how you went about composing your top 10 list? And did Sight and Sound give you any guidelines?
No, the only thing they said was, we will be happy to run comments about the film with your list, which was nice. You can look online. There are many more people contributed this time than before. It's like 800 people or something, because the internet can accommodate a lot more people. So there's room for lists and comments. And so I put a paragraph with each film, but I tried to make it very succinct, you know. But that's the only guideline. I think they also said films that are you know, like sequels and things like The Godfather 1, 2, and 3 cannot be regarded as one entry. They have, okay. If you're going to put that on the list, that would be like three films if you're going to pick, or two if you want to pick only one and two.
Yeah.
So that was a
change. If you have sense.
Yeah. Yeah. That was a change in the rules. But other than that, you're pretty open to whatever you want.
Okay. So do you want to tell us your top 10? Do you want to just list them off quickly?
Yeah, I put them in alphabetical order because, again, I think in a way, you know, I used to sort of be against lists. And then I wound up doing a book called The Book and Movie List. And I felt sort of hypocritical, but then I thought, this is fun making lists. And that's a very personal book because I just indulge myself. And I come up with all kinds of lists that are very personal, like the 10 sexiest nuns in movies, for example. You know,
things like that. The world's been clever.
Yeah. Yeah. I had fun doing it.
That's amazing.
Yeah. So I just decided to do it alphabetical. So I put AI, Artificial Intelligence, Steven Spielberg. Late Spring by Ozu, Chimes of Midnight, Orson Welles, Dr. Strangelove, Kubrick, The Magnificent Ambersons, Orson Welles, The 400 Blows, Truffaut, The River, the Jean Renoir film, Some Like It Hot, Billy Wilder, Trouble in Paradise, Ernst Lubitsch, and Wagon Master, John Ford. Mm. And the way I picked these, I figured, well, I mean, it's so hard to pick 10, and it's so kind of ridiculous anyway, but I just kind of figured, who are my favorite directors who I love the most, and what film would I pick by them, and try to pick one from each. But like with Wells, I picked two. Ambersons is my favorite film of all time for complicated reasons we could get into. It's on the list, so it's a great, great film.
Yeah.
It's a mutilated masterpiece. I have a certain love for it, partly because it's been mutilated, but it's also, so I think the first 30 minutes of that is about the best filmmaking I ever saw. Mm. But Chimes of Midnight is a really great film, so I put that. So I have two Wells films, and I should have had two Ford films, but, you know, I had to make room for Billy Wilder. 400 Blows is a film that means an awful lot to me as a personal film. The River, I think, is kind of the perfect film about life. It's about everything, life, death, different cultures, all kinds of things. It's a complete film. I love Spielberg, and AI is a film that I think is very profound, and it's also very vilified. I tend to love films maudits, as the French call them, which means damned films, films that everybody hates, I love. You know.
Interesting. So how did you feel about The Lone Ranger?
When I was a kid, I was a big Lone Ranger fan, but I identified with...
most current incarnation.
Oh, I didn't see... Oh, that one. I haven't seen that. When I was a kid, I identified with Tonto.
Okay, because, well, this movie identifies that. I mean, it's Tano's story, apparently.
I guess I should see it. I have a friend who says this is a very misjudged film.
Okay.
But I love Wagon Master. It's, you know, if it weren't for Ambersons, I might say Wagon Master is my favorite film of all time.
I've never seen it.
Ah.
I got to do that. It's so funny. My parents got it on Netflix shortly before I emailed you to ask you to be on this. And then you sent me your list, and Wagon Master was on there, and they'd already sent it back.
Oh.
So it was quite a coincidence.
Did they like it, I hope?
They did not.
They didn't like it?
They didn't like it.
Oh, really? How come?
I don't know. I mean, I haven't seen it, so.
Well, I should have a talk with them.
Yeah. You should explain why it's so great.
Well, I'll just say it is a low-budget Western without big-name stars, but it's this film about a couple of cowboys who sign up to help a wagon train of Mormons go west, and so it deals with religious persecution and outsiders, and that appeals to me a lot, and it appealed to Ford. And so they meet a bunch of Indians who are friendly, and they become friends. And then there's also a group of show people who are disreputable, drunken, licentious show people, so to speak.
As they are.
So it's all of Ford's favorite people all get together, Indians, cowboys, show people, persecuted minority group, and then there's these really bad guys who are trying to attack them. But it's Lindsay Anderson said it's an avant-garde Western. It's doesn't have much plot. It's beautiful, poetic moments of crossing a river, crossing a mountain, really spectacular photography. So it's this beautiful and comical, but has moments of seriousness, low-budget film. And to me, that's what film should be. And I don't like $200 million big productions with if I never see another special effect in my life, I'll be very happy.
Right.
So I just think that's what I would be doing if I were filmmakers just go out with a little bit of money and make a film that you love about people you love with your friends. If it weren't for some other films, I would say that's the greatest film ever made.
Okay, I should check it out then, huh?
Yeah. And I love Billy Wilder, and I put Some Like It Hot on, which I think is the funniest movie ever made, I would say.
It's quite funny.
It's quite funny, yeah. And that meant a lot to me.
Understatement of the century. Yeah, man, Some Like It Hot, it's rather amusing.
Yeah, it's a scream. Yeah. And I put, some of these films meant a lot to me personally, because like when I was 12, Some Like It Hot blew my mind. Mm. I mean, I was this repressed Catholic adolescent, and I see this film about cross-dressing and Marilyn Monroe popping out of her gown and all that. And I just, this was like, wow.
So it's interesting because when we're discussing the list, we often think that critics are ranking things based off of perhaps their influence on future cinema. But your list is very personal. Do you think most critics felt, based their list more on personal favorites, or how much do you think historical significance plays into it?
Well, I think each critic has his own or her own sense of what they should put on the list. Some people, you look at their list and they'll have Battleship Potemkin. And
right. That's puzzling to me. It's like number 11 or something.
It's a good film, but it didn't mean as much to me as Dr. Strangelove does, or something. But I mean, there are certain critics, I think, who feel that they should be responsible and put stuff on that are landmark films, whether they love them or not. I don't know. I'm who knows? I mean, what makes people do things? But I kind of feel I should be as personal as possible.
Yeah, I think, there is, of course, a place for Battleship Potemkin on the list. And it is important to, I do think it's important to take historical significance into mind when making the list. But I'm certainly happy to see that you actually picked your favorite films.
Yeah.
You know, do you make a distinction between your favorites and the greatest? They're asking you for the greatest.
Yeah, what is it? Well, I don't know what they call it. Greatest films of all time. I think that's sort of a chimera or a myth.
Yeah.
First of all time, I don't like that phrase because the films have only been around for 100 years or so.
Yeah.
So it's kind of absurd.
Plenty more to come.
To say all time.
Right.
So I don't use that expression. Yeah. And greatest, I mean, who knows? Yeah. It's sort of like, I think all you can do is say these are the films that mean the most to me. And I don't put films on for frivolous reasons, but, I mean, some people put on mildly obscure films that nobody else has ever seen or something, just to make a point.
Right.
I mean, I happen to love, say, The Exorcist II, The Heretic, which is a film that I think is a great film, and it's one of the few surrealist films made in America, but I've counted about 9 people who like the film.
I mean, that's part of why I'm doing the segment where I'm asking listeners or whoever to submit potential movies for an alternate list, because I do feel like there is a lot that is not included on the list to make room for, say, Battleship Potemkin. Not to pick on Eisenstein.
Yeah, and that's a great film.
It is a great film. It's very important. It's a very, very important film. So I'm curious about your book of movie list. You express some ambivalence about, I mean, you say it's ridiculous, but on the other hand, you have a whole book.
It's the form of jerking off, let's say.
Okay. But you don't think it serves any function?
Well, I do. I think I am ambivalent about it because I think there's a certain indulgence to it.
Yeah.
But then, it is a natural human trait. It is a good thing in a way of inventorying the things that you love and kind of sharing that with people. And I like to read other people's lists of their favorite films.
I love reading lists. I often feel like every year, at the end of the year, it's time for critics to compile their top 10 list of the best things that came out that year. And every year, they always gripe about how hard it is and how reductive it is. I understand. Nevertheless, it's fun to read, and it's also very helpful for those of us who maybe don't have time to listen to all the music that came out that year, or see all the movies that came out that year, or read all the books. So, and particularly with books, if you're going to read 10 books this year, read these 10. I think that's incredibly helpful.
In a way, that's very good because it's sharing your love and expertise. There is something great about a list if it makes you run out and see a film or read a book or something. But it can be also, Jonathan Rosenbaum writes very well about sort of the tyranny of official lists, and sometimes the mainstream media and the American Film Institute and those kind of institutions put out lists that are kind of ignorant, or they leave out independent films or foreign films. So that can be a problem with lists. But the BFI has a good record of serious film scholarship and supporting film history. But, you know, you shouldn't think because there's a list from the BFI that these are the only good films that exist.
Right. Gabe and I, when we go through each movie every week, I often feel hesitant to criticize a lot of these movies because they are in this pantheon. It's in the top 10 of the Sight and Sound greatest of all time. Mm-hmm. And I think it's also fair to question whether these films deserve their spot in the top 10 or the top 100 or whatever it may be.
I think that's a good function of lists, is to cause debate. Like, I was looking through the list again, I noticed that Mulholland Drive is pretty high on the list.
Right.
And that's a good film, but I don't think it belongs in the top 50 films of all time.
I mean,
the fact that Vertigo beat Citizen Kane, I don't think means anything.
Right. I was gonna ask you about that.
They're both great films. I mean, I love Citizen Kane. Was the film that started me on my career as a filmmaker. So Kane has always meant an awful lot to me, and Truffaut called it the film of films. But now Vertigo has toppled it. I was co-producer of the documentary Obsessed with Vertigo, New Life for Hitchcock's Masterpiece. So I'm partly to blame.
You are to blame. Yeah, in fact,
I'm going to go ahead
and blame you. Yeah. Well, okay, so you're not totally to blame, but partially.
Yeah, I'm not completely innocent.
Yeah.
In the Vertigo.
Not only have you produced a documentary, but Citizen Kane. There were two Orson Welles movies on your list, but Citizen Kane was nowhere to be found.
Yeah, this is kind of shameful. But, I mean, I finally get on the Sight and Sound thing, and I don't put Citizen Kane on the list, and I don't put The Searchers on the list.
What gives?
What's wrong with me here?
Yeah.
But I think I've kind of, as I say, kind of outworn Citizen Kane to some extent. But I knew that a lot of other people would vote for it, but Vertigo, it's a great, great film, but I happen to like Psycho as much, if not more. It means an awful lot to me. Psycho means a lot to me. But Vertigo is a very beautiful film and very deep and profound. But, you know, it doesn't matter to me that Vertigo is number one and Citizen Kane is number two. I don't really feel that Kane has been demoted or anything.
Really?
Like that.
I definitely do.
Do you?
I do. I feel like this is an injustice. Citizen Kane is clearly the better film and the more significant film, I think.
Well, you could certainly argue that, and I would probably say that too, but I think that's taking lists too seriously in a sense.
I take them very seriously.
Here I am on the podcast, which actually now I have to say your podcast has a great concept to take all these films and do a show on each one because they're all fabulous films.
Yeah.
And they're all interesting. But whether one is number 19 and the other is number 78 or something is kind of arbitrary and partly to do with fashion.
Yeah.
And in 10 years, in 2022, whenever, I guess, when they do the next one, who knows? The order will change. The Searchers has been going up and down the list. And
yeah, some of them I feel like, so Tree of Life made the list this round, which maybe that is one of the greatest movies of all time. Maybe it's not too soon to make that call. But Melancholia by Lars von Trier also made the cut, which seems odd. That seems like that's going to be a bit of a head scratcher come the next list.
Yeah, good luck to you doing a show on Melancholia.
There are some of, like, who put Shoah on the list? Whose favorite movie is Shoah?
Oh, that's a great
movie. Or no, not Shoah. What's it? Solo. Solo. Oh, God.
And I still have never seen that. Okay. I'm not particularly.
Yeah, okay. If you can skip it, that means I can skip it.
Yeah, I'm not running out to see
that. Okay.
Yeah, but Shoah is a great
Shoah
film.
I need Shoah's to see. It's just that it's 10 hours, so I'm going to have to carve out some time.
I spent, was it four nights or something, watching that the first time on PBS. It was a profound experience.
Yeah.
But you got to be, I mean, it's a big commitment of emotion to see that film, but it's well worth it.
Yeah.
It's a fantastic film. But, you know, and there's some films on the list that, you know, you or I wouldn't like or something. But I think it's a good idea for a series of 250 podcasts.
Yeah.
They'll keep you busy for a long time.
Exactly.
And each one has a lot to talk about, so you can get interesting people discussing it. And that, as I say, that's one of the good functions of lists, I think, is just raises films in people's attention to get them to talk about.
So does your participating in the list make the list feel, like the rankings feel, more or less arbitrary?
Well, I think since my choices were somewhat arbitrary and personal and quirky, I value the quirkiness of the other people's lists, too. And I really enjoyed reading all the lists, and I think anybody who wants to have a good time can go on the BFI website and just go through the list.
So, given our discussion, do you think that The Searchers is in the right place, in the number 7 spot on the list?
I think it's good that it's in the top 10, if it means anything at all. It's a very quintessentially American story, and it deals... You know, the fact that I mentioned that it's kind of an incoherent text to some extent and contradicts itself in certain ways, I think is a sign that John Ford was reaching for things bigger than himself and going beyond his usual limits. And Ethan is a character who's going beyond accepted limits, and he's going beyond the bounds of civilized society.
Yeah.
And he's going into uncharted waters. And so Ford, I think, is very brave to make this film.
Yeah.
Whether it's Ford's greatest film or it's not his most perfect film, but in a way that's because it tries things that are very difficult.
Yeah. When I watched it, I can really feel the scale, the scope of it, and that it is grappling with these really big themes. I do think that's why it does deserve its spot in the top 10. It's not my favorite John Ford film, but I think it's a worthy pick for the top 10, because I do think there needs to be a Western in the top 10.
Oh, yeah.
And... It should, I think it's fair to put in a Ford film. He's very representative of the genre, and I feel like this film is very representative of the genre. For our final segment, I want to take a moment to talk to all the aspiring filmmakers, film historians, and film bloggers, etc. Back when I was still a tenderfooted film student, long before I became the astounding success I am today, I found the advice of all of my professors to be invaluable. You know, it's scary graduating from college when you're first starting out. The movie business is so tough, you don't know if you're going to be able to make a living, which is okay at first because you're like, food? Who needs food when I have my art? But soon after you've boiled your last boot, you start to get pretty tired of the whole starving artist scene. Anyway, I'm painting a pretty bleak picture here, but the truth is, whenever I express some of the anxieties I had about my future and my career, Professor McBride always had sagely and comforting advice to offer. And so, without further ado, Joe, what is your best advice for aspiring movie people?
Well, thank you for saying such nice things. You were always a great student and a great teaching assistant, so I always enjoyed talking to you, so it's terrific to talk to you on your own show, which is wonderful. And that's what I like about teaching, frankly, is you learn a lot from your students. But the advice, I was just thinking the other day, I once asked Frank Capra, I said, I was interviewing him for Variety, and I said, what advice would you give to young filmmakers? He said, don't take advice.
Perfect.
And then I put that in I put that in Variety in a little box, and my editor said, what kind of advice is that? Why are we running this? And I said, no, I think that's great advice, you know?
Yeah.
He was kind of saying, think for yourself, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think that's an excellent piece of advice, although I've learned a lot from reading interviews with directors and writers and talking to people, wise people, old people. I mean, we're all looking for guidance to some extent from people who are wiser than we are or have had experiences we haven't had. I think when you're younger, you're eager for that. You're hungering for that.
I know I was.
Yeah.
I am.
Yeah. You know, I was and I still am, I think, you know, because you never quite totally figure it out. When I turned 40, I sort of thought, oh, I kind of understand life now.
Yeah.
But up to that point, I thought I had no clue. And then, but as you go on, you realize there's so much you don't understand. You're trying to figure it out. But I think you have to think for yourself. You can't take advice too much to heart.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you think of teachers. I had a teacher, my favorite teacher in high school, Thomas Book was his name. He was my English teacher. And he gave me some really good advice. For example, he said, it's always, you have to know the rules before you can break them, which I've heard other people say, but that meant a lot to me over the years. As a writer, you have to know the rules before you can break them. But one piece of advice he gave me, I've always disregarded. He said, never use irony because people won't get it. And he was right in a sense, because probably 60% of the time they don't get it.
Right.
But I love irony so much that I use it all the time. I've always disregarded his advice. But I'm glad he gave me that advice.
Yeah.
But sometimes, okay, he says don't do it, but I'm going to do it anyway because I'm my own person.
That's interesting. So your best advice for future filmmakers and film critics is basically...
Don't take advice.
Don't take advice.
Listen to people.
Yeah.
I think Capra was right in the sense, listen to people, talk to your elders, talk to anybody who's you respect. And I spent a lot of time seeking out filmmakers when I first came to Hollywood, et cetera. I would try to meet every filmmaker I admired and learned a lot from Howard Hawks. For example, I did the book Hawks on Hawks. And I did that partly because I wanted his advice. He was a smart, wise guy who knew a lot about filmmaking. Like he said about his script, he said, if it reads good, it won't play good, which I'm still trying to figure out what he meant by that. It's interesting. I think he means that if a script is written to be entertaining and funny to read, it won't necessarily make a good film, because sometimes good dialogue can read flatly on the page,
right.
But in the film can be perfect when it's used in the right visual context. And,
yeah.
And witty remarks in a script may not translate into the film, but it's a gnomic kind of piece of wisdom that I'm still thinking about.
Mm.
So sometimes these pieces of advice stick with you that you want to ponder.
You're allowed to think about pieces of advice,
yeah.
But you're also allowed to disregard advice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and be grateful. You know, even if you disregard something, it can set you on the right path for you.
All right. Well, I think that's all very good advice. Well, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Don't take my advice.
Yeah. Okay. So before we sign off, Joe, I just want to take a second to maybe talk about some of your current projects. I know you just recently published a book about the Kennedy assassination called Into the Nightmare. Do you want to give us a brief overview?
Yeah, this is one of the main focuses of my life has been the Kennedy assassination. I was a volunteer for John F. Kennedy in 1960 during his campaign in Wisconsin. I was 12 and I met him 3 times and he was my hero and I wanted to go into politics. That was my goal, and then he got shot. And the government didn't want to solve the crime, and that really changed my whole life. And I became a writer instead. And I attribute that partly to the Kennedy assassination. And I always think of myself as an investigative reporter looking behind the scenes. So I spent 31 years actively researching the assassination. I started in 1982 after being interested for a long time. And I went to Texas a lot, and I went to Washington. And, you know, I did a lot in that space of time besides doing that, but I wrote a very personal book about my investigation of the assassination, and I began focusing on, you know, I often think the important things are the things that aren't talked about or aren't written about. In the Tippit murder, Officer Tippit was killed soon after the assassination, and that was under-investigated, so I took it upon myself to investigate his murder in greater depth than had ever been done before, and I found out some important things about how he was involved in the conspiracy. So there are a lot of revelations in this very long book, Into the Nightmare, My Search for the Killers of President John F. Kennedy and Officer J.D. Tippit. It's a very personal book. I made it a personal saga of my growth of understanding of America through following this case, because I was a naive kid and this kind of woke me up to the realities of the world we live in. And so I chart that as well as trying to contribute what I can to solving this case.
And in addition to that book, your seminal Hawks on Hawks has been reprinted?
Hawks on Hawks came out in 1982, and it was in print for a long time, and it was in 5 foreign languages, and then it went out of print briefly, and I brought it back with the University Press of Kentucky in December. The Kennedy book came out in June, so I had 2 books out last year. So it's great to have the Hawks book back in print. It was picked once as one of the 100 best books on Hollywood and the movies by the Book Collectors of Los Angeles.
Wow. And,
but it was nice to be on the list with people like Nathaniel West. And,
that's pretty cool.
Scott
Fiscone. Yeah, you know. Just
so that was cool.
Of Scott.
Yeah.
Him.
Yeah. I wish you were around.
Yeah.
But I'm now working on a book on Ernst Lubitsch, who is one of my heroes, one of my favorite directors, and I put Trouble in Paradise on my BFI list. And Orson Welles said he was a giant, and a lot of directors revere him. And he created the romantic comedy genre basically himself, and he also kind of created the movie musical by himself. And he made films that are amazingly sophisticated and rich and nuanced and complex and very moving and very serious, but very funny at the same time. And again, I'm doing this because I think he's been neglected and kind of forgotten to some extent. I mean, people love certain Lubitsch films, To Be or Not to Be has a following. But, you know, a lot of people, you mention Lubitsch and they say, who, you know? So I want to try to make my contribution to changing that so he's hopefully more of a household name and you know.
Well, we're all looking forward to that. And we'll make sure to link the Amazon page for Into the Nightmare and Hawks on Hawks in our show page. And we'll keep an eye out for the Lubitsch book.
Thank you.
And that's The Way We Frame It, FlixWise, that is. Please come join in our discussion on the webpage at FlixWise.com. Leave us a comment on our Facebook page and follow us on the Twitters at FlixWise. Seriously, we want to hear from you. On the next episode of FlixWise, we'll discuss Dziga Vertov's The Man with the Movie Camera. And we will once again be serenaded by the dulcet tones of Mr. Gabriel Haggard. In the meantime, Professor, it's truly been an honor to have you on the show. I can't thank you enough.
Well, thank you, Pauline. It's been a thrill to be talking to my former student on her new podcast, and I'm really honored and grateful, and congratulations on having your show.
Oh, thank you. All right, listeners, we'll catch you next week. In the meantime, Professor, are you ready for the hoedown?
Yeah, it sounds like a John Ford thing, so
let's do it.
We'll go out to the motion picture, the John Ford field photo home, and have a hoedown. Yeah.
Oh, boy. All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Flies in the buttermilk, shoo, flies, shoo. Skip to my loo, my darling. Skip, skip, skip to my loo. Skip, skip, skip to my loo. Skip, skip, skip to my loo. Skip to my loo, my darling. You know, and I don't have to agree with him, but I could see his point of view. He was not just talking to his hat, or he wasn't just spouting some ignorant nonsense or something, you know, and that's instructive.
Yeah.
And I think we should have more of that. So I think that maybe hopefully your show will have.
Hopefully. Here's hoping.
Yeah. Yeah. It's been fun
no
talking.
No spouting of ignorant nonsense.
Right. That should be your motto.
We're working on it. It happens from time to time.
I hope I haven't spouted too much.
Not at all. Skip to my loo, skip to my loo, my darling. Off to Texas, two by two. Off to Texas, two by two. Off to Texas, two by two. Skip to my loo, my darling. Skip, skip, skip to my loo. Skip, skip, skip to my loo. Skip, skip, skip to my loo.